For it takes everything to be loved. To be loved is to serve as a slave. Hate demonstrates a complete freedom from pleasing others. Like wildfire, almost everyone alive was nominated, but few received the votes they needed to sustain any rank. Those who remained were public figures who'd betrayed huge groups of followers. The staggering vote totals went to media figures, actors, journalists. By far the most hate went to teachers and professors who'd been exposed for teaching students what to think in place of how to think. However, the greatest tallies of rage were heaped upon political figures, those preening public servants who constantly created bigger problems and offered themselves as the only solution. Visitors to the site marveled over the skyrocketing scores. They scrolled through the list of America's least wanted and looked for the ones nearest themselves. This pornography of public hatred. The names of ordinary people dropped away even as the vote snowballed for the famous. New distractions presented themselves, and most people forgot the list, dismissed it as they had the Tamagotchi, the Beanie Babies, Pogs. But in obscurity, the list continued to swell. The remaining names ticked upward into the millions of votes, and no one gave a thought to the list, except for the mysterious team that had created it. Visitors downloaded copies of the final version, and just as mysteriously as the list had once appeared, suddenly it was gone. The list did not exist. Charlie was determined not to look, not at first. And then he'd looked, and he wasn't going to look anymore. But then he looked some more, and what he dreaded most had come true. Both their names were on the list. He noted the date on which each name had been posted. The first had been posted only a day before the second. Neither of the two had enough votes to stay on the list past the 3-week mark. Every day Charlie checked, and every day he prayed both names would drop off the list for lack of votes. Just hours before the threshold, both names had racked up too many votes. They were both targets. Both were going to die. The two weren't in Charlie's region, but they'd be targets for some lineage. And it was completely unethical. But he drove around all day Sunday until he found a phone booth so isolated no one would overhear his conversation. The booth stood at the edge of a pay parking lot near the train station. Charlie bought latex gloves to prevent leaving his fingerprints on the buttons, and he dumped out the mason jar where he collected spare change and picked out all the quarters. He wore sunglasses and a baseball cap with the brim pulled low. He parked a ways from the phone booth and walked around block after block, always making sure nobody was following him. And as surreptitiously as sliding into the door of a dirty bookstore, he sidestepped into the phone booth. His pockets loaded with quarters, the weight of these quarters tugging his pants low on his hips, Charlie stuffed his hands in the latex gloves and dialed a long-distance number he knew by heart. The phone rang at the opposite end, and Charlie prayed for someone to pick up. "Hello," a man's voice. Charlie said, "Dad?" His father asked, "Charlie?" Away from the phone, he shouted, "Honey, pick up the extension. It's the dropout calling." Charlie scanned the surrounding parking lot. Into the receiver, he asked, "How soon can you and Mom get to Canada?" A click was followed by his mother's voice. "You're in Canada?" "No," Charlie insisted. "You and Dad need to get to Canada fast." His father chuckled. "With the big war coming, it's you who needs to do the draft dodging." His mother added, "If you were still in college and hitting the books, Charlie, you wouldn't be eligible for getting drafted." Charlie didn't want to argue, but he didn't want to tip his hand either. "Mom, that was Vietnam. This is different." His nervous fingers went back to his pants pocket, from pocket to phone, and continued to drop quarter, quarter, quarter into the slot. Each coin set off a bell. Between and behind their words, the bell kept tolling. He couldn't say as much, but they were both on the list. Even if he told them the full situation, they'd run to the police, and the police would most likely kill them for knowing. After that, the police or someone would kill Charlie for telling them. Their only hope was to flee the country. Because even if they hid out, stayed at home, whatever, someone someday would target them. Charlie tried to reason with him. He asked, "Dad, if you and I were in a lifeboat with my son, and I could only save you or him, who do you think I should save?" His mother gasped, "Charlie, you have a son." She sounded shocked and delighted. "Theoretically, Mom," he replied. "Should I save you or my kid?" To Charlie, the coming slaughter would elevate him and all his descendants to the status of royalty, but it would also kill his parents. A conundrum. They were both professors at a junior college. They dabbled in local city and county politics. There were a dozen reasons for people wanting them rubbed out. But still, they were his mom and dad. It was difficult to weigh the love he felt for them against the love he'd feel someday for his future sons and grandsons. His love for them was conflicted. His love for his unborn sons was unqualified. So, he approached the issue from a new direction. "If I get drafted, do you want me to kill people?" Without hesitation, his father said, "To save our nation, yes." The bell rang and rang. As he fed the phone quarters, Charlie asked, "What if I die?" His mother said, "God forbid." Another quarter rang the bell. Charlie asked, "And if it meant saving our country, would you want me to kill someone's parents?" His fingers sweating inside the latex glove, his hand went to his pocket and found it empty. He'd run out of quarters. The bells had stopped. After a pause, his father said, "Yes, if that's your mission." To clarify, Charlie asked, "You'd want me to murder someone's mom and dad?" His mother asked, "What's that sound?" She asked, "Are you crying?" Yes, he was crying. Charlie was crying. He sniffed as tears washed down his cheeks. His father asked, "Is this about drugs? Charlie boy, are you high?" Before they'd be cut off, Charlie choked out the words, "I love you guys." His father said, "Then why the big boo-hooing?" And that's when the connection went dead. Gregory Piper watched television, waiting for a final decision on his audition. Television was better than the internet. If he ran across himself on television, it was by accident, and it could still send a frisson of chemical euphoria into his bloodstream. Surfing the web, it was too easy to search himself and build a lifetime out of watching video of his work and perusing still images of himself. To Sunset Boulevard. On the internet, a person could spend a lifetime in egomaniacal self-worship. Sitting on the couch, he considered the cash, the $10,000, considered whether he ought to mention it to his agent or not. His hand squeezed the remote, bouncing between channels. On one, the actor John Wayne appeared, and he ambled into the center of a white space and fixed the camera with his trademark glower. Clearly, this was a sequence digitally lifted from some classic film and inserted into a new context. The Duke whipped off his Stetson and dashed the hat against the dusty leg of his chaps. "Shucks, Pilgrim," he drawled. "I ain't made it to the toilet this time." Piper clicked the remote and the image froze. It was a commercial to sell absorbent underpants. He watched in shock. Clearly the actor's estate was willing to license Wayne's image for anything. This was something few actors foresaw. How their residual celluloid self could be computer manipulated to serve as a slave, a digital zombie beyond death. The actor Robin Williams had been among the first to draft a will forbidding electronic misuse of his image. A star with less foresight, a digitalized Audrey Hepburn continued to work, shilling for Galaxy chocolates. Fred Astaire sold vacuum cleaners. Marilyn Monroe hawked Snickers candy bars. Like ghosts, Piper thought. An earworm, like a song, echoed in his head. "Adjustment day is upon us," he repeated to himself as he watched the television. He'd been asked to recite that line so often, he'd probably never vanquish it from his head. The envelope of cash was stashed in his kitchen, in a cabinet stuffed inside an empty cereal box. He would spend some on a lawyer, would finally write his own last will and testament. He'd make sure no one could harness his image after his death. That demise being peaceful and painless, and in the distant, distant future, he supposed. Back in before times, in the world you want to think is still real, Walter had driven west through Illinois. He'd ranted that the greatest proof of love's power is that it couldn't be reduced to words. Love isn't a scientific experiment that could be replicated. No man has to be a rocket surgeon to recognize love. It's like that poem about ignorant armies that clash by night. That poem, where there's no joy or cure for pain. While his kidnapped new old man had listened or slept or died in the trunk of the car, Walter had described Shasta, every detail about Shasta. He'd surmised that love is a mission a man goes on every day, a mission a man never completes until death. In that way, true love is a suicide mission. Dawson was determined not to look, but then he'd looked, and he wasn't going to look anymore. But then he looked some more, and that's when he saw the name on the list. The name had already racked up an impressive tally. It wouldn't be Dawson's lineage, but some lineage was going to earn big votes on this target. Futile as it seemed, Dawson knew he'd still have to make an effort. Someday Roxanne would ask if he'd made an effort, and he'd have to explain. Tell her how he tried. Dawson bought a throwaway phone at the 7-Eleven and took it to the center span of the Morrison Bridge, a place where no one would overhear, not over the sound of traffic. He dialed a number from memory. As it rang on the other end, he looked down on the dark water of the Willamette River and prayed the number was still valid. It had been a long time. "Hello?" A boy's voice. Dawson asked, "Quentin?" His son asked, "Dad?" Music blared in the background. "Dad, I can barely hear you," Dawson shouted. "Turn down your music." Against the music, his son shouted, "Is Mom okay?" Dawson shouted, "Your mother is fine, but you need to get your ass to Canada." Out here in public, shouting like this was risky. Cars passed, but the bridge's sidewalk was empty. His son shouted, "If you mean the war, I'm joining up. Dr. Steiger DeSoto says it's my duty as a pan-gendered individual to show the world that courage knows no gender." Whatever his kid had just announced, Dawson wasn't certain. In response, he shouted, "There won't be a war." his son shouted. Dr. Steiger DeSoto says the war is necessary to preserve human rights. It was Dawson shouting, I'm trying to save your life. His son shouted, Dr. Steiger DeSoto says I'm not a child anymore. Dawson shouted, turn down your stereo. Against the music, his son shouted, Dr. Steiger DeSoto says I'm her most promising grad student and that I should start thinking for myself. Dawson risked everything. If he told and Quentin went to the police, they'd both be killed. Roxanne would be alone in the coming new world. No one would benefit. Still, Dawson told. Your name is on a list to be killed. His son laughed, laughed and laughed. Dad, he said, catching his breath. I know. Isn't it great? Dawson didn't understand. I even voted for myself, laughed his son. It's nothing, he sighed. Dad, don't worry. It's like the new Facebook. Dawson tried to explain the truth. A beep interrupted. His son said, Dad? The beep interrupted. His son said, Dad, Dr. Steiger DeSoto is on the other line. The beep interrupted. His son said, Dad, I love you. See you after the war. And the connection went dead. And Dawson thought of the quote from the Talbot book. We must kill those who would have us kill one another. And Dawson let the phone slip from his fingers and drop to disappear with hardly a splash into the deepest point in the river's deep water. Jamal called his mom to tell her he wouldn't make it for dinner on Sunday. He called from a hotel suite in Albany. Eating around him, perched on various chairs and sofas, as well as seated on the floor, the group of them eating room service, his fellow teammates awaited their turn on the phone. Not his whole lineage, just a segment of his squad. They were silently drinking wine and beer from the minibar. They were listening as each took the phone and called his family. He wanted to share the secret, to tell his mama about the Declaration of Interdependence and how it promised a homeland where no race would live under another like an occupying army. Each race would call the shots in its own homeland, and no minority would be called out by the hostile stares of the majority. Like-minded could dictate their own culture. Children wouldn't be schooled to serve as human colonies of alien cultural imperialism. On the phone, she demanded, "What do you mean you're not stopping by?" He wanted to tell her about his lineage. For the first time in human history, each line of power wasn't going to be based on blood and marriage alliances. Jamal looked at the man who'd invited him, then the man he had invited. This cohort was only a small segment of a lineage that crisscrossed the nation tonight. These men, eating room service pizza, eating club sandwiches and sliders and pretending not to eavesdrop, their brotherhood was based on mutual respect and trust and admiration. Here he was, one link in this chain of men, none of whom were his enemy, every one of which expected him to be nothing less than a hero. He wanted to read to her from the Talbot book, the passage that went, "The last thing a black man wants to be is another fake white man. The last thing a homosexual wants is to be another imitation heterosexual. The last thing a white man wants to be is another phony paragon." On the phone, his mama asked, Jamal, not all screechy like before, she asked, what aren't you telling me? If he told her anything, she'd rush down and insinuate herself. That was her way. Tonight, on the last night of the old regime, the lines of power were assembling outside state houses and courthouses. Those invited by the invited by the invited in lineages linked by trust. They met their fellows for the first time and gasped, in happy awe at their own numbers. Tribes chosen from the best, not the weakest. They gathered to wait outside of city halls and all the places where elected traitors would return the coming morning. If a target's vote count was astronomical, a team might be dispatched to lie in ambush outside the target's home. Otherwise, they camped in ready groups, no one mentioning their task. The time for practicing and planning had passed. Their coming actions had to be as automatic as putting on their pants before their shoes. Most were quiet, saving everything for the next day's work. To his eyes, the group in the hotel suite looked like that painting, that church painting showing Christ and his homeboys chowing down, that Last Supper picture, only with them passing a phone so man by man each could call home and make his goodbyes. Not to explain himself, but to make his peace. They were an army of lone wolves. For Jamal, the idea of power didn't translate into sex and drugs. As he saw it, those short-term pleasures were the distractions men sought when they had no real power. To wield power, real power, meant a peace of mind and satisfaction beyond the numbness and dumbness that the bong and the whore could provide. Power meant access to anything and everything, meaning a man wouldn't need to hustle and hoard. It meant a life unencumbered by backup plans, alternate routes, second choices. The Talbot book stated it so well. Each group must inhabit a homeland where it constitutes the norm. Otherwise, either self-destroying hatred or other attacking self-aggrandizing occurs. Drinking, drugs, and toxic sexual behaviors arise when cultures are compelled to share public space. No culture should be held to the expectations and subjected to the withering gaze of another. Young people in their own nation-state, they'd be released from the college prep standards of the alien European culture that it sought to standardize every human being regardless of his natural talents and inclinations. The currently imposed one-size-fits-all code of behavior. Power meant Jamal not having to present himself as an imperfect copy of someone he'd never wanted to be in the first place. His lineage had rejected the prescribed, standardized everything of laws and schools, that chutes and ladders game of rules and taxes, where it took forever to climb, but only one misstep sent a man into poverty or prison. Jamal sensed how others were waiting to make their calls. He listened to his mother's worried breathing and the kitchen noise behind her. He wanted to tell her that after tomorrow, the world would be different. Through him, her life would be improved and noble. They'd, all of them, be as close to royalty as the Declaration of Interdependence allowed. Everyone's success depended on everyone, and due to that, none wanted to disappoint such high expectations. Each strove to be worthy of the honor bestowed upon him by his comrades, by his tribe. Jamal wanted to tell his mama everything. He wanted to say he loved her, but everybody would hear. Instead, he asked, "Feed my dog." She sounded relieved. "You want I should feed Bouncer?" He could hear her deciding, like she wanted to yell and tell him to drag his ass home and feed his own damn dog, but like she didn't want to yell if this might be their last talk on Earth. He exchanged looks with the man he'd invited, a man who knew how Jamal's mama could get. Finally, he asked, "Please?" Something he'd never heard, he heard now. Over the phone, his mama started to cry. So even with his team listening, he said, "I love you, Mama." He sniffed. He couldn't help it. "Just feed my dog, okay?" His mama sniffed. Hushed, so he could barely hear, she said, "Okay." her voice scared. Jamal ended the call and handed the phone to the next man. Among those who waited for the dawn were the former journalists. They bided these last few hours outside what remained of the major newspapers. They loitered on the sidewalks around the television headquarters, honing their resolve was the knowledge that the few journalists who had retained their careers did so by inflating lies to terrify and enrage the public trust. Telling the truth wasn't sufficient power. As consolation, the remaining journalists convinced themselves that no absolute truths existed. This new untruth they propagated as the new truth. The entertainment value, the ability to titillate or provoke, came to be the litmus test of any new truth. Their goal now was to shape people's minds and warp information to that purpose. Honest reportage, which people in a democracy needed as badly as they needed to breathe, ceased to be a priority for the Fourth Estate. Those journalists who couldn't be corrupted, they were discarded. They tested each other with photos displayed on their phones. Each a smiling headshot of a distinguished man or woman with neatly styled hair and a gleaming smile. Gray hair or dyed, wearing a necktie or pearl necklace. And the challenge was to name the person and give his or her vote tally from the list. Or to recognize that the photo was an innocent who'd never appeared on the list and wasn't deemed a target. These were the hollow-cheeked, flinty-eyed former news hounds who gathered outside radio stations and cable networks, ready to return objectivity to the public airways. On that same night, Esteban and Bing bid a dozen of their closest friends attend a potluck, supping from paper plates loaded with mulligatawny and mole de pollo. The local segment of their lineage finalized their list of targets. Despite their weeks of drilling, apprehension hung in the air like the pungent curry. As the assembled men ate, Esteban read aloud from the Talbot book. "It's living among heterosexuals that makes the homosexual feel abnormal. Only among whites do blacks feel inadequate. And only among homosexuals and blacks do whites feel threatened and guilty. No group should be blighted by the intellectual expectations and the moral yardstick of another." Standing in the center of the group, the book open in his hands, he read, "Art should not be social engineering. Art that seeks to repair people must be rooted from society." The next line, Bing knew by heart. "Bearing that in mind, we must allow each man to decide upon his own happiness." Before he was with Esteban, Tiny Bing had been embroiled in an unhealthy relationship with his pimp. Despite Audrey Hepburn being his lifetime idol, Bing's life had been a far cry from that depicted in Breakfast at Tiffany's, swanky nightclubs and jumping out of the top of supersized birthday cakes to the vociferous applause of mobs of love-struck Shriners. No, in actuality, when Bing's former pimp spoke, he was all the time, "These dicks ain't going to suck themselves, bitch." So when Esteban had made his play, the tiny younger man listened. The older, sophisticated Cuban had invited him to take up arms in their lineage of power, and Bing recognized an improved circumstance when he saw it. Closing the Talbot book and carefully setting it aside, Esteban proclaimed, "Queer bodies have always been the shock troops in Western civilization." When inner cities had rotted down to the charred skeletons of their once elegant housing stock, he said, it was queer bodies that had brought back those crime-ridden neighborhoods. Queer homesteaders had no children to risk in the failed school systems. Strong queer backs and bright queer minds had nothing except their own lives to risk. Those intrepid pioneers had settled the harsh wilderness of decayed Savannah and the derelict wastelands of Baltimore and Detroit. Those queer settlers had arrested the death spiral of each local tax base. With queer resolve, they'd tamed the lawless urban frontier. With queer sweat equity, they'd boosted the land values. Here and there, hushed cries of "Amen, brother," punctuated Esteban's fevered delivery. "When nobody else dared," he called out, "it was queer courage that nailed the roofs back on those houses. It was queer determination that repaired the dry rot and made the ghetto into a safe investment for white bankers." He described how rising property values had attracted a spate of heterosexuals. Improved schools and close proximity to city services had brought many more. Clearly, Esteban had merely started to build his case. He looked from listener to listener, letting a stretch of quiet pass before he redirected. "For better or worse," he jabbed a plastic fork forward for emphasis, "queer bodies have always been the advance guard in emerging politics, too." Citing recent scholarly writings as proof, he described how Malcolm X had gone on the down low, servicing the wealthy white men he'd later returned to rob. "But do we celebrate the subversive queer energy of the man?" he demanded. "That hero who sought to subvert power by any means possible?" A general chorus of "no" and "hell no" went up from the small crowd. "Don't even get me started on James Baldwin," Esteban wailed. "The man, the prophet, the poet laureate who wrote the liturgy of his entire race, and his people won't celebrate his queer spirit." Not only did Esteban stew a mean chicken marsala, but he was holding forth with a pep talk the power of which Bing had never heard. Food and drinks went ignored, and people set down their spicy meals and raised their hands and swayed together in their show of unity. Tiny Bing could only grin. He was proud to witness the rhetorical might of his man. "Not so helpful, but just as historic and just as ignored," wailed Esteban, "was another little queer boy." Teasing his listeners, he described a child wildly in love with a classmate who rejected him. This same boy had grown to become a decorated soldier before finding himself impoverished. His youth had opened the doors and wallets of wealthy male admirers, and the young man soon found himself leading a political party, and not long after, helming an entire country. "Arguably the most powerful leader of the 20th century," Esteban spat the words in disdain, "and nobody will speak of how his queer heart brought him to greatness." This demagogue, this lovelorn mustachioed gigolo, had built an entourage of like-minded queer leaders and launched a style of visual imagery that continues to be emulated to this day. But when the radical queerness of his political movement was exposed and ridiculed by the world press, that same leader called for the wholesale execution of his entire queer power structure. "In one night," Esteban ranted, "they were summarily executed, and the man himself was the only survivor, forced to hide his queer shame and suffer it to his suicide." His audience hung on Esteban's every astonishing utterance. "That man," he swore, "in all his queer power and cowardice, was none other than..." He looked to Bing. The younger man offered, "Not Adolf Hitler." Esteban nodded in wordless affirmation. Here his audience gasped. The boy whom young Adolf had loved in grammar school, he revealed, was Ludwig Wittgenstein, a talented Jew who would mature to become a kind of anti-Hitler, a brilliant philosopher and teacher unafraid to conceal his queer self, inventor of Wittgenstein's duck rabbit. As for the night when so many of Hitler's compatriots were slaughtered, that was the legendary Night of the Long Knives, when the Nazi Party purged itself of its founding queer members. Unspooling before the spellbound potluckers was a history heretofore forbidden to their ears. "Yes," Esteban forged onward, "even in the noble women's movement." After the work of Betty Friedan, after the labor of the 1960s and the blood spilled by a generation of queer women, the leaders had evicted their queer sisters in an effort to make liberation more palatable to mainstream middle-class women, heterosexual women. History would always repeat this pattern. Queer foot soldiers blazing the path and being dismissed once the heavy lifting was complete. Already being distributed among them, among all the tribes and lineages, was a book. Because all great doings require their manifesto. Every copy of this book was bound in the richest blue-black and bore its title and the name of the author on the cover in gilded lettering. Be it the Communist Manifesto, the Bible, the Quran, the Feminine Mystique, or Saul Alinsky. Consider every hipster, Esteban sighed. One hand fluttered to demonstrate how words now failed. He shook his head as if perplexed. They're covered with tattoos and riddled with piercings, but few of them know the name Jean Genet, and none know of the urban aboriginal culture of the 1970s queer San Francisco that revived the primitive arts of body modification. He allowed the energy in the room to settle. Every one of them felt the burden of failure, the steadfast manner in which history had refused to celebrate or even acknowledge the events of queer history. Many sniffed back tears. Their feast of unity began to feel like a funeral. Esteban snuck a glance at Bing to reassure him that all was not lost. Beginning tomorrow, he said in a soft growl, history will no longer ignore us. His voice rising, he continued, our lineage of power will prove itself. We will harvest many targets, many more than any other lineage. He shouted to be heard over the rumbling agreement around him. Bing took up the rallying cry. We will prove our queer power and earn the right to control the nation that controls the world. Lost were any further individual words, as the lusty huzzas of all filled the loft. Charlie and his fellows bowed their heads and prayed for the souls of men who had never found their destiny. They invoked the dead and invited those ancestors to join them. And the war party swelled with the living and the not. As Garrett Dawson had invited Charlie, did Charlie eventually invite Martin, who'd invited Patrick, who'd invited Michael, who'd invited Trevor, until their lineage stretched from ocean to ocean and city to city. And on that night, the great chieftain lines were complete. Theirs was a tailgate party. The air scented with charcoal and barbecue sauce. Rough men attired in brimmed caps and camouflage print hunting ensembles. Above them reared the state house, the way all grandiose edifices are designed to make the people outside feel powerless, and those showcased within feel omnipotent. The bloated, useless shape of its marble dome. It was a citadel to be taken. The new Bastille. Garrett Dawson glared up at it like the ridiculous stage set it was, his pale blue eyes filled with contempt. The marble dome, washed with floodlights, appeared so like a full moon frozen on the horizon. Like Moloch, fed on slaughtered children, yet always hungry. It loomed above them. No police officers asked their business. No one gave them a second glance. Tomorrow, they'd no longer be men who measured their time by red traffic lights and their pleasure by pints of microbrews. Charlie put two fingertips into his mouth and called for silence with a long, deafening whistle. Dawson was about to speak. Not a tall man, but built strong and made lean by a lifetime on the shop floor, Dawson modestly accepted the crowd's silent attention. "The queers," said he. And he faltered. Beginning with a new breath, he repeated, "The queers became artists because nothing they could do in public came naturally. From their first awareness," he explained, "they'd had to study and mimic behavior instinctual to all others. To survive, they needed to observe and remember, and in doing so, they'd served as the scholars, artists, and clerics of civilization. Likewise, the blacks had raised families, To survive, they'd built careers and businesses. Blacks had established churches and fought as soldiers and set themselves as moral paragons of virtue that outshone their white counterparts. But identity politics, Dawson continued, has reduced the homosexual to nothing but his sexual preference. It has reduced the black to only his skin. And each has become a caricature of his former dignified self. Men like Dawson and Charlie had not left their drill presses and lathes in order to rescue the gays and blacks. Their lines had formed to battle the same corrupt identity politics that were now forcing the white races into one monster stereotype. Theirs was perhaps the meanest of all caricatures. Instead of being salt-of-the-earth machinists and carpenters, they were being compelled by modern politics to rally under one flag as goose-stepping Nazi NASCAR stormtroopers. Gays had been coerced into a two-dimensional identity that had reduced them to hypersexual behavior, and that behavior had decimated their numbers. Blacks had been told they were powerless unless they became thugs, so that anything that could be construed as disrespect led to them murdering one another in staggering numbers. "White men," Dawson vowed, "will not be stampeded into adopting a similar self-image." On the contrary, the actions they took, the actions of all the lineages, would destroy the ideological slavery of current politics and replace it with a world where proven heroes would steer the course. Veiled by the smoke of grilling meats, the men prayed to be worthy of the myriad creatures that had died to bring them life. They surrendered themselves to their destiny and asked for the strength to fulfill their labors. As they called upon their forefathers, they reached out to their sons yet to be born and recruited them to lend their strength. Late that same evening, Senator Holbrook Daniels dismissed his usual contingent of bodyguards and jogged alone along the National Mall. His trim physique filled him with a secret pride. Indoor desk work and lightweight resistance training had left him a spry specimen of masculinity, and he reflected on his privileged status among the Washington elite. He'd easily live to be 100. It was a sweet deal, being a United States senator. Tomorrow promised a free haircut in the senatorial barbershop, followed by a hefty luncheon bill he could ignore in any of the city's finest eateries. An endless stream of wide-eyed congressional pages were waiting to be groomed as interns, even as sexy college-aged interns were being marshaled for his sexual pleasure. And, lest he forget, there was the war resolution to rubber stamp. 2 million surplus men, undistinguished young men, tomorrow he needed to resolve their lives with a stroke of his pen. It was all in a day's work. A tough job, he chuckled to himself, but somebody had to do it. As he jogged through the darkness, the night breeze carried the aroma of barbecued pork. Flames flickered orange from a line of grills. As the senator passed, a grim company of working-class men fell silent and watched him. Bottles of beer looked small in their hairy fists. One bearded ruffian cranked his neck and emitted a thunderous belch. Their silent gaze unnerved Daniels, so much so that he almost stumbled over the edge of a seemingly bottomless pit. There, sunk in the lawn at the foot of the Capitol steps, yawned the huge excavation he'd watched grow from his office window. Another stride, and Daniels would have tumbled into its depths. That no one had fenced it off with barricades, it was insane. Such a hazard. He sensed the beer drinker's eyes on him, and Daniels turned to confront them. Self-conscious and suddenly feeling vulnerable, he wanted to tell them that they were trespassing. The mall was closed to cookouts and alcohol, but something in their cold eyes made him hold his tongue. Many of them held cameras and filmed him. Others swilled beer. The steaks hissed and spat, dripping gobbets of hot fat that sent up geysers of bright sparks. Men glared sullenly at him as they lifted ribs and drumsticks to their mouths. Their huge teeth made a horrible sound, gnawing against the bones and stripping away the gristle. In his futile anger, the senator stood at the lip of the deep hole and pointed into its emptiness, shouting, "When will this be filled?" When no one responded, he shouted, "This is a hazard!" An oafish brute broke wind. Determined to have the final word, Senator Daniels shrieked, "Someone could get killed!" He wasn't on CNN. Without the acoustics of a marble chamber, without a bank of microphones and amplifiers, his voice sounded frail and shrill in the open-air darkness. Several of the roughnecks looked from him to something nearby. He followed their pointed glance. There, neatly stacked along one edge of the abyss, were bags of something. Piled as neatly as bricks, white canvas bags formed a wall almost as tall as the men. Daniel squinted to read the labels printed on the bags. In the flickering light of scorching grease and through the dense smoke of burning flesh, the labels were almost illegible. As a car passed along First Avenue, its headlights swept the scene. For an instant, they were all illuminated. The senator, the beer drinkers, their ragged hole, and the bagged supplies staged beside it. In that moment, the senator could read the labels. "Quicklime," the words said. An inexplicable frisson of terror pricked the hair on the back of his neck. It took all of his lean, gym-trained muscles, all of his self-discipline, to turn away from the scene and begin running. Putting distance between him and the mob with every stride, Daniels boiled with confusion and rage. Tomorrow, he swore to himself, he'd make a few telephone calls. Tomorrow, heads would roll, damn it, and that dirty, dangerous hole would be filled. His telephone woke Gregory Piper before dawn. According to the screen, it was his agent calling, but Piper knew better. He'd pick up, and it would be a young voice, entry-level young, an assistant telling him, "Hold for a call from Mr. Leventhal, please." A loud click would indicate he'd been put on hold to wait while his agent finished another call, or two. Piper knew where he stood in the pecking order. He looked at the bedside clock, 5:30, Pacific Standard Time. It wasn't even banker's hours in New York. Over the phone, a voice asked, "Gregory?" Piper sat upright in bed, stunned to hear his agent. It was dark outside. He could hardly hear the freeway. The voice continued, "Have you seen the television?" Using his free hand, Piper dug among the sheets and blankets for the remote control. "Which channel?" his agent snapped. "Any of them," he added. "All of them!" Piper found the remote and switched on the television near the foot of the bed. Filling the screen was himself, wearing his blue Savile Row single-breasted suit. Looking directly into the camera, he said, "This is Talbot Reynolds." Piper switched channels, and there he was once more, saying, "Absolute Monarch." Piper switched channels, and there he was once more, saying, "Absolute Monarch." Piper tried a new channel, and he was there again, saying, "Appointed by the Council of Tribes." Over the phone, his agent demanded, "Did you sign anything?" Without waiting to hear the answer, he said, "We're still waiting on those contracts." Between every televised glimpse of himself, Piper found no sports, no music videos, no advertisements. On a fourth television station, he was saying, "El día de ayuntamiento está sobre nosotros." He considered the envelope of cash, and if accepting it had implied a contractual agreement. It was stupid, but he hadn't mentioned the money to anyone. If he could avoid the tax obligation, he would. On a new television channel, he was proclaiming, "Before creating anything of lasting value." That was his improvised line. Now the beer-swilling, cruller-munching production crew. They'd have to give him a writing credit on the project. Another channel showed him saying, "We must first create ourselves." The clock radio on his bedside table went off, but instead of a morning traffic report, it was his voice saying, "We must first create ourselves." Over the phone, his agent stormed, "We have already issued a cease and desist." The doorbell chimed. On television, dignified and handsome, delivering his best Ronald Reagan tinged with his best JFK, Piper declared, "Adjustment day is upon us." The phone held between his hunched shoulder and his ear. Piper rose from the bed and found his bathrobe. The doorbell chimed again as he tied the belt. The television repeated, "Adjustment day is upon us." To anyone except him, this would look like a repetition of the last take, but Piper heard the slight variation in how he stressed each word. In his ear, his agent swore, "It's on the radio and all over the web!" Over the phone's tiny speaker came the layers of sound, each offset by a microsecond. "Adjustment day is upon us." An entire choir comprised of Talbot Reynolds, the synchronized voices resonating like a chant. "Adjustment day is upon us." Piper crossed his living room and squinted through the peephole on his front door. From the bedroom television, over his phone, from neighboring apartments, the words came, "Adjustment day is upon us." At his door stood the man with the cauliflower ears and neck tattoo of a swastika. Piper racked his memory for a name. The low-rent cinematographer. Into the phone he said, "They're here." It was dawn, with the light rising behind the visitor. Edging toward morning rush hour, the noise of the 101 grew louder. His agent asked, "Who's here?" The chorus of words seemed to fade and blur. "Adjustment day is upon us." Becoming audio wallpaper. A new normal. White noise, like the freeway. Room tone. Piper opened the door. He had the name. "You're LeManley, right?" His phone demanded, "Who's LeManley?" From every direction, "The list does not exist." The man, LeManley, reached into his jacket and produced a pistol. Without a word, he leveled it at Piper's chest. From a neighbor's window, "The list does not exist." As much as the impact, the noise of the gunshot rocked Piper back on his bare heels. His bathrobe billowed open, revealing white undershirt, grayed chest hair. He dropped the phone, but didn't collapse. Not at first. His own voice, rich and echoing now from his own telephone, began to repeat, "The first casualty in any war is God." Echoing from the television in the next room. His field of vision began to narrow until he was looking down a long dark tunnel to where the gunman was walking away, following the sidewalk to a car parked at the curb. A rushing sound louder than the freeway roared in his ears. Near the car, the man muttered, "Damn," and slapped himself on the forehead with the butt of his palm. With fast steps, he hurried back to the apartment doorway. He reached in, grabbing the doorknob, and pulled the door closed behind him. The knob rattled, as if he were testing to make certain it was locked. Outside the closed door, his rapid footsteps faded into the distance. A voice, Piper's voice, proclaimed, "May each man strive to be hated. Nothing turns a man into a monster faster than the need to be loved." This left the actor alone in his living room. His own voice, recorded, duplicated, overdubbed, immortal. The voice of Talbot Reynolds continued on and on, even as Gregory Piper sank to his knees and bled out on the rug in front of his own image on television. The Senate Majority Leader took the final vote, and it was unanimous. As he announced passage of the War Resolution Act, a voice shouted from the spectators' gallery, "Friends, Romans, countrymen," a man shouted, "lend me your ears." It was Charlie, in a moment for all the history books of the new future. Those borrowed words, words Charlie's lineage had deliberated over, words that would become as famous as Nathan Hale's. The majority leader gaveled for silence. He called for the captain of the guard to remove the disruptive young man. The guard took no action. In the gallery, a second man stood and shouldered a Dragunov sniper rifle, and the red pinprick of its laser sight found the center of the senator's forehead. The triggerman was Garrett Dawson. That same year, grouse hunting season never opened. Nick had lived through worse. At first he worried the police were after him. He caught a whiff of smoke and went to look out the window. Flames rolled up the brick sides of an Urban Outfitters down the block. No sirens wailed. More worrisome, no one stood in the street to watch. What scared Nick most was the fact that nobody was looting. He dialed emergency but couldn't get a signal, not as much as a recorded message. He'd spent the last few nights hiding in the coffee shop where Shasta had worked last. They'd made the mistake of giving her keys and the alarm code before eventually firing her. He'd escaped his place with nothing but his stash and the clothes on his back. He'd eaten all the chocolate-dipped biscotti and was mildly curious when the morning manager would arrive to evict him. That's when he'd smelled the smoke. The wind was driving the fire in his direction. Nick foamed some milk and mixed in a dozen shots of espresso and some vanilla syrup and called it breakfast. Nobody had messed with the cans of spray whipped cream, so he worked each nozzle to huff the nitrous off the top. He checked the sell dates on the grilled chicken ciabattas. He washed his face at the bathroom sink and finger-combed his hair. When he looked next, the fire had jumped to Baskin-Robbins. Considering how much stock he'd eaten and all the places he'd left his fingerprints, he wasn't unhappy to see the inferno bearing down. Just this teeny bit fucked up, he'd started to feel safe again. Anyway, it was around time for the marijuana dispensaries to open up. That would do until First Methodist at lunchtime, the Narcotics Anonymous meeting, the primo place to score. Then, the first van arrived at the curb. Outside the front window, a second van screeched to a halt. The first was hefting a satellite dish and aligning it with the sky. A familiar woman took her place in front of a camera and began to narrate the fire scene. A circus like this should have drawn a crowd of the curious. That was the scary part. No one gathered to watch. No car slowed to rubberneck. There were no cars, period. The street was otherwise empty. Another news crew arrived and set up to broadcast, as did a fourth. A wall of newscasters stationed themselves in front of the blaze. Nick's ass vibrated, the back pocket of his jeans. His phone, with a call coming in. Keeping his eyes on the fire scene, he put the phone to his ear and asked, "Walter?" With no immediate reply, he tried, "Shasta?" A man's voice said, "Adjustment day is upon us." An automated robocall. The caller ID read private. The voice repeated, "Adjustment day is upon." But Nick hung up. Already the phone was vibrating with a call from the same private number. Last on the scene were the emergency responders. A police squad car followed by a single engine company. Without unrolling hoses or tapping hydrants, the firefighters and officers positioned themselves in a perimeter outside the filming. Cameras swiveled to watch them. Nick studied it all through the coffee shop window. In some recess of his brain, he knew what was about to occur. Instead of watching content being made, he was watching history being made. This was just like that batshit story Walter had been trying to sell him. That was it. More than ever, he had to find his buddy. Walter would explain what was going down. Because just like Walter had predicted, the police officers drew their service revolvers. The firefighters unbuckled their slickers and shouldered rifles. And just like Walter said it would happen, this unlikely firing squad let loose with a July 4th flurry of blasts, as brief as a string of firecrackers, filling the air with drifting gusts of white brimstone smoke. And before the last echo had died away, the uniformed men were waiting among the fallen journalists. Seizing each by a fistful of perfectly coiffed hair, they lifted each head. Following close behind, a man holding something bright was dragging a burlap sack. At each head, he brought his bright tool down with a single stroke. A knife, Nick realized. And the man reached back to drop something into his bag. An ear. Walter said they'd take the ears. Ears smeared with pink makeup and powdered with talc. Ears with tiny transmitters still plugged into them. The man with the knife had a name. Nick knew him from somewhere. No, not hacking off dead ears, but somewhere regular. And repeating in Nick's head was a memory of a man's voice, this same man reciting, "Hi, my name is Clem," repeating, "I'm Clem, and I'm a junkie." Adjustment Day is a misnomer. Altering human history took little more than an hour. The police stood aside. After years of being branded villains by politicians and the media, the police turned a blind eye as citizens lugged duffel bags into every state house, every courthouse, city hall, into every college administration building. That morning, the police knew the calls to report fires and murders were only bait, lures thrown out to draw the media into an ambush. Every year, voters and taxpayers were killed by criminals. Policemen were killed by criminals. This year, crime would seek out the lawmakers. Participating here in Adjustment Day would expunge all of Bing's and Esteban's criminal charges and warrants. It would eliminate Jamal's student debt. Stray targets, of course, had to be stalked down emergency fire exits, across parking lots, underneath parked cars where they cowered, weeping. Others hid behind locked office doors that required breaking down with fire axes. Even with these stragglers, the old regime would be eradicated by lunchtime. The words of a former teacher came to mind. A while back, a professor had lectured Jamal. Professor Brawley talked about the culture of the Hellenistic Greeks, how the Greeks had valued comedy above all other theater. Their comedic plays had far outnumbered their tragedies because they believed that all human endeavors looked trivial and laughable to the gods who watched from on high. The gods found mankind endlessly funny. But when Christian culture supplanted the Greeks, the Christians destroyed most of the comedies. Stories of tragedy reinforced the Christian viewpoint, so the church preserved Oedipus the King and Medea and Prometheus Bound, and eradicated all that did not celebrate the church's ideals of suffering and martyrdom.